You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
People break down into two groups. When they experience something lucky, group number one sees it as more than luck, more than coincidence. They see it as a sign, evidence that there is someone up there watching out for them. Group number two sees it as just pure luck, a happy turn of chance. Well, sure, the people in group number two are looking at those 14 lights in a very suspicious way. For them, this situation is a 50-50. Could be bad. Could be good. But deep down, they feel that whatever happens, they're on their own. And that fills them with fear. Yeah, there are those people. But there's a whole lot of people in the group number one. And they see those 14 lights. They're looking at a miracle. And deep down, they feel that whatever's going to happen, there'll be someone there to help them. And that fills them with hope. See, what you have to ask yourself is, what kind of person are you? Are you the kind that sees signs, sees miracles? Or do you believe that people just get lucky? Or look at the question this way. Is it possible that there are no coincidences?
Hello, and welcome to City of Man podcast. I am not Coyle Neal. This is Jordan Poss. We are in the Christian Humanist Radio Network Halloween crossover season. So I've taken over the show today. Coyle will be on some other show talking about some other topic. But what all the shows have in common this Halloween is that we're talking about the films of M. Night Shyamalan. Joining me today is Katie Grubbs, an adjunct professor of English at Houston Baptist University in Houston, Texas. How are you doing, Katie?
I'm doing great. I'm excited to be on City of Man. I've got my CH Radio Network punch card ready, and I can check this one off. I've never been on City of Man before today, so I'm excited to be here.
Awesome. Sounds good. Also joining us is Marie Hawes, a research assistant on an edition of the Tudor translations of Christine de Pizan. How are you doing, Marie?
Great. Thanks. I'm also happy to be here and haven't been on this show before, so very glad to be joining you today.
Very cool. Well, this is a lot of firsts. This is my first time hosting an episode of a show, so this is we'll see how we do. We can't do worse than Mel Gibson's family does in this film, which if you have not picked up on that reference, I'm not aware of Mel Gibson being in any other M. Night Shyamalan movies. So we are talking about Signs. This is Shyamalan's. Well, depending on where you start his filmography, this is his third or fourth major movie. Certainly the third really noteworthy one, following on from The Sixth Sense and Unbreakable, which I believe there are other episodes of the crossover event about those. So if you're not listening to all the shows on the network, subscribe to them and you'll pick up on those in the coming week. But this film, just to say a little bit about the filmography, because this is something that I'm kind of interested in, and I definitely want to talk more about this as we go forward. Shyamalan has such a weird, interesting career trajectory, because I remember distinctively, because he first hit it big when I was in high school, and everybody was talking about how he was the next Hitchcock, right? And as we'll talk about, Signs, he has explicitly acknowledged The Birds as an influence on Signs, and I think that's pretty apparent once you know that. But he had a string of really big hits with Sixth Sense, Unbreakable, Signs, The Village, and then kind of fell off of a cliff until here recently. And I believe Danny Anderson on Sectarian Review is doing Split, which is sort of the movie that put him back on the map. But for that means that for me, Signs is – I'm not a – particularly nostalgic person about high school. I kind of prefer to forget those years, just me personally. But Shyamalan as a filmmaker feels very much like an artifact of that time in my life, just because of those three movies in particular. I'll say more about that in just a minute, but Katie and Marie, what are y'all's personal connections to this film? When and where did you see it, and why did y'all choose this movie to talk about in particular?
Well, I, like you, Jordan, first saw this back in high school, and I think we actually rented it on VHS soon after it came out. And I just remember enjoying, like, the twist ending and also its scariness. And it's still actually pretty scary for me to watch, just sort of affirming the eternal creepiness of cornfields for me.
Yes, definitely.
And I like this one particularly of Shyamalan's films. My favorite after The Village would be my first favorite, I suppose. So I was interested in discussing it. I hadn't seen it for a few years, and watching it this time, it was surprising sort of how old it felt, yes. Which makes me feel old because of remembering how new it was at one point. What about you, Katie?
So I'm slightly older than you guys. So this movie, I saw, it came out just before I started my freshman year of college. So when I went to see it, it was with my new roommates. It came out late July 2002. And that's when I started college. It was about a month after that. So it was actually one of the reasons I wanted to talk about it is Signs was the first Shyamalan film I ever saw. I didn't see The Sixth Sense. Mm-hmm. Because when it came out, I've never liked scary movies, and I didn't know at that point that his brand of scary is something that I could handle. You know, I didn't know that it would be something that would be fine. And by the time I found out that The Sixth Sense would be a movie that I could probably watch and feel totally fine about, I already knew the twist, and I thought, what's the point? So this was my first one, and I had quite an exciting time when I went to see Signs because one of my roommates had already seen it. We saw it in the theater. She'd already seen it, so every time there was like a jump scare, she would grab me. Like physically, like she would like grab my arm or something. So it made it even scarier. I always remember, and I don't know that I saw it twice. I think I saw it twice in the theater, and I don't know that I watched it again, that I've seen it again until I watched it to get ready for today. But strangely, I remembered almost everything. And I think one reason for that is because at least in this movie, but I think in a lot of his movies, particularly with dialogue, it's so spare. It's not a wall of words in this movie. And so I remembered a lot of the lines. I remembered things people said because it's kind of quiet and simple, the things that often that people are saying. But I really enjoyed watching it again. And I don't know if he said this on his own episode, but my husband is also very much a fan of this movie. He's always loved this movie. So we had a lot of great conversations about it this week at our house.
Nice. Yeah, it came out like you were saying, July of 2002. So I would have just graduated from high school and was fixing to go to college. And that's the way I was raised. We didn't we didn't think movie theaters were evil, but we just didn't go because our school requested that we didn't. But with the release of Lord of the Rings, all bets were off, and I started going to movies. So that summer in particular, I have a lot of very vivid memories of seeing movies in theaters for the first time, like normally, you know. One of the reasons I wanted to do this episode is first of all, some of those memories, because this is one of those that's so stamped so strongly on my mind, but also as a kid I had a kind of morbid fascination with alien stuff, and I say morbid because it terrified me. I would watch Unsolved Mysteries and then not be able to sleep, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and my parents would have to reassure me and everything, but I couldn't stop thinking about the stuff and investigating the stuff. They even at one point when I was a kid had to take the blades off of my ceiling fan because the little brass bracket that held the blades on looked like E.T. And I didn't need that staring at me.
That's so sad.
Yeah. So I think they call it confrontation therapy, where I kind of gradually got myself used to these kinds of things. But to your point, Katie, I've always found dread a much more potent emotion than just straight up horror. I still don't.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, I still don't like horror. I don't want to see somebody taken apart with a chainsaw. That's there's just something wrong about that, you know, to me. But being kept in a state of just immense, overwhelming dread, I eat it up. And at this stage of the career, Shyamalan is still doing that really, really well. And the cornfields and stuff. I can't remember the last time I watched this. It has certainly been at least 15 years, because I did own this on DVD after it came out, but I don't remember watching it much past when I was in college. So it's been a while. I've enjoyed that. So I've already talked a little bit about Shyamalan's overall filmography. He had made a movie or two before The Sixth Sense, but The Sixth Sense is what put him on the map, and it is. I think I have other favorites, but I think Sixth Sense is probably his best movie, the best executed. And it helps that he works with really immensely talented people, which I think we'll talk about the cast later. But even technically speaking, his cinematographer on a couple of these movies is Tak Fujimoto, who shot Silence of the Lambs and would go on to shoot the John Adams miniseries. And he really brings a very subtle but like palpably tense atmosphere just to the look of the movie, which I enjoy. Marie, speaking of The Village, there he was working with Roger Deakins, who is one of the great cinematographers still working today. I think Fujimoto has retired now, but so it's interesting to me. I'd be curious, maybe we can return to this later, but watching this now, knowing what I know now about his career, and also knowing that at the time he made this movie, he was 6 or 7 years younger than I am now, which also feels weird. Watching interviews with him, it feels like I'm watching, you know, like a younger, you know, somebody I need to step up and mentor for the behind the scenes of this movie. But I'd be curious maybe to talk later if we can see signs, no pun intended, of maybe him kind of running out of steam, you know, heading into that sort of limbo of the middle of his career. I don't know, but the highs were so high early on, the fall became that much more dramatic, and it's tempting to look for advance warning of that here. So let's talk about the movie itself, and I want to give at least a quick plot summary for anybody who has not seen the movie. And if you have not seen the movie, we are going to spoil it. There's no way not to. This is the entire discussion is going to be a spoilerific discussion. So if you have not watched it and want to see it, you know, straight, pure, you know, go in cold, which I don't know how that's possible now. But if that's the case, you know, pause now, come back to us later after you've watched it. Would one of y'all like to summarize the plot really quickly?
I mean, I can.
All right, go for it.
So Graham was a minister and now is not, because his wife was killed tragically in a freak car accident. She wasn't even in a car. She was walking down the side of the street. And that event, which seems to be 6 months in the past at the beginning of the movie, so very recent, has made him lose his faith, seemingly. And he has stopped being a minister. And he lives with his son, who seems about 10, little girl, who seems like she's maybe 4 or 5, and his brother, Meryl, who has come to live with the family to help in the wake of their bereavement. And he used to be a very, very talented baseball player. And they live out on a farm in Pennsylvania. And then strange things begin happening on the farm, strange noises, they see weird things. But it all starts with these crop circles that appear in the field. And that's basically the first scene of the movie, almost, is these crop circles appear. As the movie goes on, they watch various things on the news. It becomes clear that this is a worldwide event, but also the very closer threat of aliens in their midst, on their property, gets ever, ever, ever more intense, leading to a kind of final confrontation. A providential saving that causes him to regain his faith and his job as a minister by the end of the movie. That's my brief plot summary. I hope it was brief enough.
Oh, absolutely. Marie, anything you'd add to that? I think Katie got most of the bullet points we would talk about.
Oh, yeah. I think we're we'll get into some of the more specific details in a minute here, no doubt.
Yes, definitely. Okay, so one question I did include is, you know, genre-wise, this is an alien invasion movie, but it's a really atypical alien invasion movie. This is not what's the one from the 50s, The Day the Earth Stood Still. You know, they're not you don't have the president in the Situation Room, you don't have the military deploying. It's very, very stripped down, and I think one of y'all used the word spare earlier. Most of the film just takes place in and around this farmhouse in the middle of these cornfields, and I think that for me certainly makes it feel a lot closer to home because I don't know what the president is like in the Situation Room. You know, Lord knows what it's like now, but I do know what it is like to be out in the dark in the woods near my house and something make me feel suddenly uncomfortable in this familiar place. Did anything about the way the movie handled the alien invasion thing stick out to y'all at all? I mean, anything that fits genre conventions, anything you felt was out of the ordinary?
Well, it's definitely, like you said, not this typical alien invasion movie where we're seeing the global battle against the aliens take place. It's not like this Independence Day thing or some Michael Bay kind of thing. Because I think what's accomplished with the way the aliens are treated here is that it really keeps the focus on the story being about this family and this slow process of trying to heal from their trauma and their loss. And of course, the discussion of faith in the film as well. So it's like the story isn't really about the aliens at all. They're just sort of the means for telling this story about the family. And it's also perhaps atypical in that the aliens are largely off screen. And I think a lot of people actually would agree that maybe that would have been better if they stayed off screen for the entire time instead of having that alien that we see head on at the end, because those special effects just haven't really aged very well. But yeah, it seems like the aliens are just sort of the way of telling the story about the family rather than the family being sort of the spice for caring about the characters as we watch this global invasion take place or something like that, that we would get in a more typical alien invasion film.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a really good way to put it because I have gradually learned about myself that movies that are about aliens are less interesting to me. If you can build that into some kind of human drama, I think maybe the best recent example of that was Arrival, where the
Yeah,
again,
That's a great.
the aliens, and again, there's a movie with a ton of dread, right, but no real horror, which I think Denis Villeneuve does really, really well. But there's a movie where, again, the aliens are, you know, the plot in a way centers around them, but they're not really what the movie is about. And I think Shyamalan does that very, very well here. Well, we've already introduced briefly some of the characters and especially their distinctive quirks. There's Mel Gibson as Graham Hess and Joaquin Phoenix, a really young baby-faced Joaquin Phoenix as Merrill Hess, which is interesting to think about where he was in his career because by the time I saw this movie, I think the only thing I'd ever seen him in was Gladiator. So watching Commodus get a buzz cut and play this kind of, you know, considerably more wholesome and positive brother figure to Mel Gibson was really, really strange. But of course, knowing where he's gone now, you know, brings something else to the movie. And Beau and Morgan Hess, played by Rory Culkin and Abigail Breslin. What are I think it's worth talking about because these characters are not that they can't be just glibly substituted for any other character. They do have distinctive traits and quirks. Graham, of course, is the one drawn in the finest detail, and I think Mel Gibson is awesome in this movie. To the point that, you know, maybe we can talk later about Shyamalan casting himself in the film. I think I do have thoughts about that. All of the characters, to a greater or lesser extent, have some distinctive characteristics that end up actually playing an important role in the plot. Do y'all want to talk through a few of those?
Sure. Well, with Graham's brother Merrill, I've already mentioned that he had been a professional baseball player, and he has a particular skill of swinging the bat very hard. So that's one of his quirks that comes up in the film. Beyond that, it seems like he's really looking for direction in his life after having left baseball, and looking for some kind of authority figures to direct his life as well. So his relationship with Graham has a lot to do with that need.
Yeah. And there's also that scene where he goes to the army recruiter. The creepiest recruiter in the world.
I wrote that on my notes this time. I didn't remember him being so creepy when I saw it.
Right. I mean, they used a bunch of his dialogue about probing and whatever in the trailers, and I remembered those lines. But man, he is enjoying scaring this kid way too much. But the army recruiter thing was interesting too, and I like the way you put that with him looking for authority and guidance, because I guess this movie would have been shot the summer before 9/11 and then released the following summer. But that scene where he goes to the recruiter, you know, like there's a threat and I want to do something to stop it. That was so much of the atmosphere, at least, you know, among the guys that I grew up around in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. The timing is, even now that scene really, you know, I had this almost like sensory memory of that particular kind of feeling, again, the kind of anxiety and the unsureness. And again, that search for guidance, I really like the way you put that. I could definitely see that with him.
Me too. And I, cause I felt like when you were talking about him searching for authority figures, that's a good way to say it. The way that I kind of interpreted it when I was talking about it yesterday with David, is that he plays, and I think it's great, but I think Phoenix plays the role very childlike. Like,
yes.
And mm-hmm. You know, I mean, he's a grown man, but like you said, he doesn't seem to have a lot of direction, and he, except for the one scene with the sheriff, I think she's the sheriff's deputy. He doesn't have the kind of bitter sarcasm that you might expect from somebody, yes, in his position. He's, you know, but he's a younger brother living with his older brother, and the other two people in the house are children. And it's almost like he's just another kid, you know. He doesn't seem to have the instinct to take over watching them when Graham is gone. So these kids are basically left to themselves. You know, he's just kind of acting like another kid in the house. And I thought it was interesting, though. I wonder if one reason he wasn't written as more bitter, or if he's not playing it as more bitter, is because the thing about Merrill is that he can't ever see himself as having washed out of baseball through no fault of his own, because we know the reason he's not playing anymore is because he swings at every pitch, right? That's what you learn in the recruiter's office, is he had all the home run records and the strikeout record, mm-hmm, because he never doesn't swing. And so, you know, in some ways he has himself to blame for his predicament. And so it's more of a kind of childlike lost feeling. What do I do next? Rather than an embittered, you know, people just got me down and I can't believe they did this to me. You know what I mean? It's a different kind of, if somebody just said washed up baseball player, you might expect a more bitter character, and he's not. He seems like a lost little boy in some ways. And it's a I told David, it's a movie about masculinity to me. And I think that one of my favorite parts of that movie is that I think that at this point in their lives, 6 months after the death of Graham's wife, Morgan is the best man in that house.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and he's 10 years old, but like he's grilling the meat because his dad's going to burn it again. And he's the one who has to take out the dog when the dog's going to attack his little sister, which I know his dad, I mean, the reason his dad's not there is because he's out with the sheriff's deputy. He's not being a negligent dad or anything, but like his instinct is to always protect Bo. And it seems like that he's the one in the house most attentive to her needs. He seems to have decided that he's not going to get any help from his dad. And so he's doing things on his own. Like, but and that was really, really struck me way more than it did when I watched it as a very young person. Now that I'm a parent, watching him parent her because his dad is just sunk in his grief was really hard this time, but really good. It was good to watch. It made it that much more interesting to me.
Yeah, this movie changes a lot in the 15 years since I've watched it. You know, I have gone through college and grad school and gotten married and had kids and, you know, boys and girls and it or boys and a girl. And yeah, this movie hits you in a completely different spot. Now, you know, the aliens make me anxious, sure, but I was so much more invested in the family dynamic. I'm glad you brought up the form Meryl's bitterness takes on, because that's such a useful contrast to Graham, who absolutely blames somebody else for his problems.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, there's Ray Reddy, the guy Shyamalan plays himself, the guy who just randomly fell asleep at the wheel one night and killed Graham's wife. And it's clear Ray Reddy blames himself too. It's not like he's, you know, blithely carrying on with his life. He's clearly carrying the weight of this accident. But Graham blames Ray. I think it becomes clear later on that even though Graham has given up his faith, he still believes in God and is mad at him. Right. Maybe we can talk about this, the scene in the basement later. But yeah, it had not occurred to me the kind of counterpoint that Graham's loss and Meryl's loss form to each other. And Meryl, yeah, he's rewatching the film, I was like, man, Phoenix's character is really underwritten, but now I'm seeing how much depth there is actually layered into that, because he's disappointed in his big brother because his big brother is not there for him. Maybe in a way that Graham sort of looks at God as well. So we mentioned the sheriff's deputy, that's Officer Paskey, played by Cherry Jones, and Ray Reddy, who's a local veterinarian, played by Shyamalan, who is the guy who, as we mentioned, kills Graham's wife. Is there anything in particular we want to say about them?
Only that Cherry Jones has the perfect voice and demeanor for this movie.
Yes.
Like, she was perfectly cast.
Yes.
And I'd forgotten when I saw the movie the first time. I don't know that I noticed her because I hadn't seen her in anything else. But now I've seen her in other things over the ensuing years. I liked the bookstore people too. They're in one scene.
Yes.
And the even the and I was thinking it's basically a movie about four people. But whenever you do get those moments with other people, they're all either really evocative or really funny. Like the girl in the pharmacy who wants to confess to him, even though he's not Catholic. She's not even Catholic. Like, but it's in that like 2 minute scene, you get all these things about her. Like maybe she's a person who kind of likes the idea of religion but knows nothing about like what to do or how to do it. All she knows is this guy used to wear a priest collar. I bet I could confess to him. Like it's just so those are some of my favorite moments, because those are the moments that lighten for just a minute. They lighten that dread. They lift that sense of dread for just a minute, and so it lets you catch your breath before you plunge back into the sadness and fear again. And I really appreciated those scenes. But I did think it was interesting that there were so few other characters. You know, you would think in a small town, you know, in a different kind of movie of a different genre, you get like folksiness coming out the woodworks. There'd be like a million characters with funny names or funny quirks or whatever. This was more like you only get to see a few people from their community, because mostly they seem to live this isolated life among the cornfields.
Yeah,
who, by the way, who's maintaining these cornfields? That's the other thing. Sorry,
Jordan. I kept reading this whole time. Why do they have a cornfield? He's not a farmer. He was a priest. What was his wife the farmer? If maybe. So, who's doing the corn now? If Meryl's working at the gas station, what?
Exactly.
I don't know.
It's a mystery. Yeah, unless they're renting out their land. We have friends in Kansas that rent out the fields around their house. Maybe that's what's happening. Maybe a totally different farmer's growing this corn. But in that case, why didn't that guy show up screaming about the crop circles and all his flattened corn? It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, that never occurred to me until this time watching through the movie. And I was like, wait a second. For somebody who lives on a farm, Meryl does not do much farming.
If any.
Yeah, and so, yeah, somewhere way back in the back of my mind, I was trying to figure that out. And what I eventually settled on was that, you know, what you just said of like letting somebody else grow something on his land. But yeah, that we never see that guy. But yeah, the other characters, that is something else that Shyamalan does really well in this movie, is you get exactly enough of the other people for it to feel like a real town and a real, you know, neighborhood. Like, do we ever see those guys that Graham thinks are pranking him? I don't, you know, it's
the
like
one guy's at the recruiter's office, but it's like a one scene, but the rest of them, no. Yeah, you don't see like the brother, whoever the so-and-so brothers, they keep referring to them like they're a gang, but you never see it.
the Wolfington brothers. Yeah. And like, yeah. So, I mean, you get these little hints that there's other stuff going on in this community that we're just not going to focus on right now, which makes it feel so much more real and so much more lived in, which I always appreciate in a movie. And the guy in the bookstore counting, I can't say soda, counting Coke ads. I have to point out, he plays a really small bit part in, the Coen brothers movie, Miller's Crossing. And it's just everything I've seen him in, he gets like one or two minute scene, but you can't forget him because he plays these really striking, you know, minor characters who have, they have opinions about things, which is great.
I love that that's his type. He's that guy.
Yeah. Yeah. He plays the guy who has an opinion on something. And I'm glad you mentioned, Cherry Jones's qualities, because she really felt like female cops and female deputies, people in these roles that I have met or known, where they have to bring a kind of authority, but also kind of gentleness and grace. And she does it magnificently, especially in the flashback at the end where she is meeting, like, you watch her face and there's so much going on there when she is clearly steeling herself to deliver the worst news Graham is ever going to hear. But she's also trying to attend to him and watch what his reactions are going to be. That is a really, really dynamite scene. My only wish, and I mentioned that Shyamalan kind of stunt cast himself as Reddy, because it's kind of fun seeing him in a movie, again, doing that kind of Hitchcock thing, although Hitchcock, I don't think, ever gave himself lines in his cameos. But Shyamalan is clearly not an actor, and the scene in particular where Graham and Ray finally speak face to face, you know, before Ray disappears to the lake after having trapped one of the aliens in his house. If there had been somebody with some serious acting chops for that one scene, I feel like that would have landed so much better. And what I think of is a movie that came out about the same time, which is The Green Mile, where there's one scene with Gary Sinise playing this this guy who knows something about, you know, John Coffey, this prisoner in Tom Hanks's prison. And even though he's in it for one scene, the power with which he delivers the information that he's there to deliver into the plot is so good. The scene serves its purpose in this movie. I just wish maybe we had somebody who could have actually matched Gibson and what he's doing in that scene. I don't know. That's my opinion. Do y'all have any thoughts on that?
Well, just on... Yeah. When it comes to the other secondary characters in general, I did sort of wish there had been any chance for the film to pass the Bechdel test, because there's just not enough women talking to women. There's not enough female characters to get the women talking to women going on. So that was a little bit. I wish it could do that, but. What were you going to say, Katie?
I was just going to say that scene is not, you're right about that, Jordan. And I didn't think about that last night when I was watching it, because, you know, it was always going to be an awkward scene anyway, because this is the first time they've talked. But I think that you're right. It's not bad, but it could have been so much better.
Yeah.
And but again, it's not his style, and it is a pretty spare movie. I would have been really interested to see maybe a different actor in that role and get to see the scene where he finds the alien in his pantry and has to freak out and try to shut the door. Like, all, you don't see any of that. Like, so the first encounter that any human person has close up with one of these things is completely off camera. And you just hear about it, you know, from Ray Reddy, who, as we've said, is not the most convincing person. I don't know. I thought his best work was when Mel Gibson walks up to the car and he's kind of sitting in the car staring off into the distance and he hasn't said anything yet.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I mean, I think, and not because he's that terrible, but just, I think that he can convey a lot with his eyes and his face, but it's his vocal delivery that's not as good. And I think you're right about that. He seems kind of detached and not as emotionally present. I think, to me, his best cameo is The Village, because you never see him. he's a reflection in a window or something.
Yeah. No, that's a good way to put it. Yeah, when he's just staring there, when he seems shell-shocked, That's more powerful than when he starts talking. I think you're right.
Yeah.
And, you know, the not seeing him fight the alien, or also not, you know, seeing some female characters speaking, I think that is down to just the perspective that the movie takes. I imagine that if this were written as a novel, it might be first person as told by Graham, because he is the viewpoint character for every scene that I can think of. No, in The Recruiter, it's Merrill. So we do leave his perspective a couple of times, just to get extra information in the town. But I mean, almost the entire movie is you know, revolves around him, or is given to us through his eyes. And that does serve well for some of the tension, because when he goes into Ray Reddy's house, I don't know about y'all, but the scenes where a character walks through the aftermath of something and you're not being told about it, you're not getting a info dump, you're just kind of piecing it together from where you see the chairs overturned and furniture pushed against a door or whatever, that always really raises my antenna and really gets me, you know, it really begins to build tension, which I think does pay off fairly well in that scene, even with the CGI fingers. So yeah. The one other detail that I just thought of that I'd want to mention, though, and this will be really important for our when we really start to unpack the themes of the movie. So Graham is a widower, and Merrill is disappointed in his athletic career. Bo and Morgan have their own struggles, right? Morgan is asthmatic, and apparently severely so. And for the first part of the movie, it feels like, you know, how some characters in comedies especially will kind of pull out their inhaler as like a punchline.
Yeah.
That's how it feels at first, but it actually begins to really matter to the plot, which I thought was a nice subversion of what is often treated as a joke. And then Bo, you know, and having small children in the house, this is 100% real. Just the weird, finicky preferences about things. She will begin and not finish what looks like 20 glasses of water a day, always finding some invisible problem with the water. I've actually joked for years with my wife about this, because she leaves only partially finished cups of coffee around. So we have compared that often. I said someday when there's an alien invasion and the aliens are, you know, going to be poisoned by coffee, this will save us. But
right.
But both of these things, these seemingly random character traits are going to eventually play a role in the climax of the film. So we've talked a little bit about Graham's crisis of faith and some of the events of the plot. So do either one of y'all want to describe the climax of the movie before we start looking at kind of Gibson's big speech?
I'll let you take that one, Marie, since I did the plot summary earlier, because I don't want to be talking too much.
Sure. Okay. Well, the climax of the film, where these little character quirks that we've been mentioning all come together to create this seemingly providential salvation for the family, is when, after the actual like global alien invasion seems to have come to a close and the aliens are withdrawing from the Earth, the family emerges from the basement because they need to get asthma medicine for Morgan. And they find that there is still one alien in the house, the one that had been injured by Graham when he went to the pantry in Ray Reddy's offices or house, wherever that was. And this alien releases a poison gas on Morgan, and the family is at a standstill. What are they going to do? And then Graham has his last flashback to Colleen's death, where she tells him to see and to tell Merrill to swing away. And Graham, standing there, realizes that Merrill's baseball bat is on the wall behind him, and he tells Merrill, swing away with the baseball bat. So Merrill then attacks the alien, and in the process knocks over some glasses of water onto the alien, and we realize, water is poison to these creatures, and that's why that's why Bo has this quirky character trait of always thinking the water is contaminated, because it's worked out now that there's like hundreds of glasses of water around the house that can just be knocked onto this alien and incapacitate it. So Meryl is able to defeat the alien, and meanwhile, Morgan is taken outside by Graham, and he realizes that Morgan has not been killed by the poison gas because his lungs were closed due to his asthma condition. So it's like, this is the providential aspect for Morgan, that he had asthma in order to save his life here with this incident with the alien and the poison gas. So it's this sort of confluence of events at the conclusion that seems to work together to bring Graham to a realization that God is protecting the family, and he ends up returning to faith in the last scene. We see him dressed as a priest again.
That's good. I had forgotten even a couple of those elements. There are really a lot of pieces in play in this movie. I thought was a really good summary. So I want to backtrack from that really quickly, because I think the climax dramatizes a theme that is laid out in a pretty – we'll read the speech in just a second. But Mel Gibson does a really, really good job of delivering this speech looking like a person who's really hurting as he talks through this, as he and Meryl talk at an earlier point in the film when they finally decided to sort of confront the reality of whatever this is that is happening around the world. So to look at that here, let me read through this speech just really quickly, because I think the climax is meant to dramatize this conflict for us and also give to us what Shyamalan thinks about this. So Meryl and Graham are talking, and Graham says essentially, and I can't possibly do this the way Mel Gibson does, so just go watch the movie. He says, people break down into two groups when they experience something lucky. Group number one sees it as more than luck, more than coincidence. They see it as a sign, evidence, that there is someone up there watching out for them. Group number two sees it as just pure luck. A happy turn of chance. I'm sure the people in group number two are looking at those 14 lights, which are some of these alien ships apparently appearing over Mexico City in that case. People in group number two are looking at those 14 lights in a very suspicious way. For them, the situation is a 50-50. Could be bad, could be good. But deep down, they feel whatever happens, they're on their own. And that fills them with fear. Yeah, there are those people. But there's a whole lot of people in group number one. When they see those 14 lights, they're looking at a miracle. And deep down, they feel that whatever is going to happen, there will be someone there to help them. And that fills them with hope. See, what you have to ask yourself is, what kind of person are you? Are you the kind that sees signs, sees miracles? Or do you believe that people just get lucky? Or look at the question this way. Is it possible that there are no coincidences? So that is Graham's unpacking his response both to what has happened to his wife, because at two points in the movie, you hear people say that it is as if, quote unquote, it was meant to be, that his wife Colleen was struck down by Ray Reddy's truck, which is a very... It is definitely an attention grabbing way to say that, because you usually hear that kind of language about like a romantic relationship or something, not, you know, severing a person in half with a car. At two different points earlier in the film, people say that about the death of Graham's wife. But also there is, you know, the worldwide rush to try to interpret whatever is going on with the sky and the signs, the literal signs and the corn pastures. So with that in mind, and having talked through the climax of the movie where you see some of this stuff play out, what side does it appear that Shyamalan comes down on? Why? What do y'all think of that? And what are you know, if we can establish what side he thinks is right, and I think it's fairly clear. Which side which of the two kinds of people he thinks of himself as? What can we make of that perspective? I know, Marie, I know you have thoughts on this. What do you think?
Well, given what you've pointed out about how we follow Graham's point of view so closely in this film. I think that sort of would make us lean toward one side more than another, in that Graham seems to come to this realization that there's this providential protection going on. There are no coincidences for him in the end, even though he starts off in the other group of people. So we could see the film coming down on that side with the film's ending and Graham's perspective on it, and the way that everything, these seemingly unrelated things with, you know, Beau's habit with the water, Meryl's batting skills, Morgan's asthma, all seem to work out to keep the family alive. But I think there is a little bit of just the question being left open too, because we could take the ending as just being reiterating in a very forceful way the same questions that have been raised throughout the film, asking us to decide what it is that we're looking at and like which group of people we're in. Like we have Morgan saying right at the very beginning, "I think God did it," when they find the crop circle, or when they're listening to the baby monitor and Graham says it's just static and Morgan says it's a code. So we have these different perspectives, and the film is asking us, when we're looking at the universe and the patterns of our lives, do we think it's someone's joke, or do we think God did it? Do we just hear static, or do we think it's a code? And yeah, I think the film does lean toward the second option. I mean, after all, it's definitely, humanity is not alone in the universe in this film. But it's also, I think, sort of leaving the question open and just sort of restating it more forcefully in the conclusion too. Because the series of this confluence of things at the end, you could take this as being just another 14 lights you have to decide what to do with.
That's a good way to put that. Katie, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it, to me, this, the ending of this movie, it feels like, I think Shyamalan seems to be suggesting that, you know, that there's something there, that I think that the end of his movie seems to be saying that this family, their particular quirks were orchestrated, you know, that they seem to be under the protection of God. But I also think it feels like a film made by someone who has ideas about faith and religion, but not necessarily a well-defined or consistent personal theology. Because I think this movie's turning on providence, but if you take it seriously, that what the end of the movie, and I think you're right, Marie. I do think that there could still be questions depending on which kind of person you are and all that kind of stuff. But if you just take it at face value that these things were kind of providentially foreordained for this family to protect them, including the death of the mom of the family, all to protect the rest of them from this alien invasion, well, then that's a providential worldview. That's a situation where God is in control of all of these things and has set them all in motion. But then in that case, what about these aliens? Like, is there incursion? Has that also been planned, foreordained? Is it not? And in that case, is God not in control of aliens, but just in control of this family or humanity? Like, and you know, my husband accused me of like taking it too seriously, or like pushing at it too hard. But that was one of the things I was thinking this time, is that if you just kind of take it, you're like, well, that's nice, you know, and it is a beautiful picture of a person's, David's word was deconversion. But then subsequent return to faith. But I was thinking too, it struck me this time that one of the things that's interesting about this movie is that his return, in a lot of ways, he's like somebody like Job, and that he's lost something really important, and he's, you know, in the depths of grief or whatever. And you know, he's lost family, and it feels like that his life is just, you know, barren now. But unlike Job, what brings him back around to faith is not a kind of realization and acquiescence that God has the right to do something like that to him, but instead that God basically shows him there was an explanation. It wasn't random. Like, you know, he gets given a reason. And that's kind of interesting too, that's the, you know, it's which, and I know I keep saying this, but it's because we literally talked about it this morning. In our conversation this morning, what David said is that it's a movie about a guy who is not, he doesn't really believe that God's not there. He's worried that God is hostile, you know, that God's not kind. And so the explanation he gets in the end of the movie shows him that it was done for a good reason and not at random or as a way of trying to persecute him. You know what I mean? And so that was interesting too. I hadn't been thinking about it that way. I'd been thinking of him as a guy who seems to believe God's not even there anymore. But I suppose you can see that that's not true because, you know, when Morgan's having an asthma attack or whatever, he's talking to God and, you know, he's talking to God saying things like, I hate you. Like, and it seems clear that he does think that God is still there. He's just, he just thinks God has it out for him. And that I feel like is almost sadder than him, you know, having some experience where he thinks, oh, there's no God. It's all just random. Like he seems to think God has it out for him, which, is why in the end he's comforted and returns to faith is because it is made very clear to him that there were reasons and for all of these things that have happened. And so that's kind of what I was thinking about regarding that, you know, those issues surrounding that central speech. And it is, I mean, it's an interesting way that he did it because, you know, Graham says more lines in that one scene than he says almost in the rest of the movie. And so it's clearly meant to be the centerpiece, you know, the central thing that you're supposed to pay attention to. With regard to him as a person and what he thinks now, you know, particularly when at the end of that scene, then it takes a turn. It's kind of a nice little speech. And then he says kind of angrily, but that basically shows that he's the person who thinks that he's on his own. There's nobody that's going to protect him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a really good point. And, you know, I mentioned Tak Fujimoto, the cinematographer, is a testament to Shyamalan's confidence as a filmmaker and the skill of the people who are making it with him. That, I mean, that scene plays out in a couple of very dark, static, unmoving shots of just faces only half lit. So, I mean, basically the only light in the scene is in the, you know, the glistening tears in Gibson's eyes, which is, and I mean, it blew me away this time. I had forgotten entirely about that speech, even though I kind of vaguely remember that this was a theme of the movie. I think too that the movie does kind of, there's room for ambiguity because certainly Graham becomes convinced that, you know, he's one of the kinds of people who thinks there are no coincidences. I mean, he even has the line, he says almost explicitly, or almost, I can't remember the line verbatim, but something to the effect of, that's why he had asthma. Like that's why his son. Yeah, that's why his son has had this condition his entire life is for this moment, which to me, and anytime I start digging around in the whole providence question, to me it always ends up raising a lot more questions than it answers. Yeah. And I think you're right that Shyamalan is somebody with ideas but no coherent system of thinking about them. And again, he's like 29 or 30 when he made this movie and it's very ambitious, but not that I have any better answers than he does, but I might not be tempted to mess around in these questions. So having said that, you know, to me, a couple of things occur to me. Like I said, you know, being able to say my son has asthma specifically for this reason, and he will theoretically, you know, probably continued to have asthma for a very long time, you know, for this moment, or, you know, my daughter has this weird quirk with the glasses of water, or my, you know, even my wife was killed in a horrible accident so that she could say these things that would enable us to defeat this CGI alien. But the speech that Graham gives us lays out a false dichotomy, doesn't it? I mean, this is you know, it seems like your two choices are either, you know, I'm being a little silly here, but it's like he's presenting two choices as being Richard Dawkins or John Calvin, but with no, you know, yeah. There are things like Molinism. There are things, you know, there are people who simply refuse to you know, pry into these questions because they think they're basically unanswerable. So with these questions raised, what can signs teach us about, you know, the roles of faith and providence in our lives, or what can we, you know, how could we fruitfully learn from this or reflect upon this, given that the movie has maybe bitten off more than it can chew, but has raised some important questions.
Well, I think what you're saying about how this approach that we get with the there are no coincidences sort of view of providence, this seems to sort of raise more questions than it answers. I think that's true. It does seem like a pretty kind of simplistic view of providence and of faith. And there's sort of obvious problems with faith being grounded in looking for this evidence of God using these small miraculous interventions for like some people's physical and this worldly benefit and protection, not other people's, does raise a lot of questions. And it doesn't seem great to me that the grand evidence of God's presence in the film is found in the ability to slowly beat a wounded creature to death. It's not, I don't know. I don't know about that. So I think that to me, faith and providence has to be something that much bigger than just there are no coincidences. And you know, God's sustaining love is so much greater than these individual circumstances or events, even things like whether we live or die. It's just so much beyond that. And I think there are a couple things maybe we can get fruitfully from the film, though. One might be that faith can be a choice, like we can choose to rest in that divine sustaining love and feel there's someone who cares about us. Maybe. Possibly another thing we could get from the film is that a big way that we experience God's love in our lives is through other people. So Graham's faith is in this process of being restored at the same time that his family relationships that have been ruptured by this trauma are also slowly being healed. And it's kind of actually ends up being sort of pretty much the same process in the film. And in the final scene of the film, we see that the outline of the crucifix that was on the wall outside of his bedroom, which was this absent cross that was a symbol of his lost faith at the beginning of the film, it's now been replaced by this collection of family pictures. And I think maybe that's actually not really an entirely inappropriate substitution to make there, having people where the cross was, because these connections with others, that's really a big part of God's presence in our lives and our bringing God's presence into other people's lives, more than like quirky coincidences working together kind of thing would be. There's something a lot bigger than what the film would be saying about that there are no coincidences model of faith, I think.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And talking about the, you know, this, that I recorded a podcast yesterday too, and something that came up there was the idea of, you know, man is a political animal. That is, we are social creatures, and we need each other, and you know, are not wholly ourselves without human community. And Graham has, he is treating this as if it's his problem alone. Like he's the only one really struggling with this. And so for the first half of the movie, whether it's his younger brother or his children or even the people in the town, everybody is coming to Graham with trouble and problems, and he's kind of shunting them away because he's dealing with his hurt, right? And only by reconnecting does he begin to get over what's happened to him.
He's very isolated.
Yeah, he's trying to handle it on his own, which is not what we're made for, right?
That was one of the parts that I loved the most too, when I was mm-hmm. talking earlier about the maturity of Morgan as a character, is that the scene I hate the most in that movie is the dinner scene where he makes them all their favorite foods and he just like starts being ugly and mean because nobody wants to eat. But you know, mm-hmm. he's yelling at everybody and his son comes to him, like, because he can see his dad starting to break down because he's finally like, he can't hold his emotions in anymore, you know, but his kid reaches out to him and that lets him break through the wall. right? Like this wall of isolation he's built around himself, which, and that's, it's so funny. It's such an emotional scene and everybody's crying. But then there's that moment where they focus tight in on Joaquin Phoenix and you just see Graham's hand just grab him by the shirt from out of frame to like pull him into this big group hug. Like, it's just such a funny moment. But yeah, it takes his kid kind of, you know, even though his dad was just screaming at him, he comforts his father, and that enables his dad to reconnect to the rest of the family. Like, you know, and so he walks into his dad where his dad's just trying to deal with it all alone, which, and now that I think about it, I do think in some ways that, I really don't want to sound essentialist in any way at all, but I do think that often, in films at least, that's depicted as more of a masculine way of trying to deal with grief or trauma, the idea of pulling away. Yeah. And that's why I say it's depicted, because I don't want to be essentialist, because everybody deals with grief in different ways. And I don't want to be like, oh, this would be a different movie if it were women, but it kind of would be a different movie if these were women. I think that he's trying to depict this man as dealing with his grief in a way that I think would resonate with lots of guys, or at least that you see depicted on screen a lot, which is pulling back, retreating, not wanting to share feelings, all of those things. And so I think he's kind of depicting a certain type of grief journey, masculine grief journey, that we've seen in other movies before. But in this situation, it's a little bit different because you have this whole other plot happening in the background of invasion and incursion and all this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. And that is a really, really good point. And I think something that stood out to me about that scene in particular, because that scene is, it hurts to watch. And speaking from experience, I mean, there is a tendency, at least for me and for other guys that I know, to, again, you know, when we're wounded, behave like a wounded animal, you know, and lash out at anything that approaches, which Gibson, you know, does not do until that scene, really. Something that struck me is that as, you know, Gibson's got a long career of playing very volatile, energetic, in-your-face kind of characters. But he is 100% believable as a respected local minister who has lost his faith, but is very gently trying to just bow out of the tradition, and doesn't want to take anything away from anybody else, which is, you know, a little condescending, but I was very, very surprised by how restrained and how gently Gibson tries to remind people that he's not a reverend anymore throughout the movie, even to the point of, you know, him being uncomfortable cursing when they're trying to scare away what they think are pranksters.
That scene is so funny. That's the funniest scene in the movie.
I'm insane with anger.
That is my favorite line in the movie. I'm insane with anger. I actually found a video on YouTube earlier this morning where it's just that line over and over again for 10 minutes.
I tried
100%. I turned it on and just waited for Sarah, my wife, to tell me to turn it off, and it took about 30 seconds. But yeah, I mean, he has been under so much pressure and, you know, consuming himself with grief, and when he finally lashes out at that dinner scene, it hurts so much. But I love what you point out with it. It's Morgan who brings him back into the family, and that's the turnaround, right? That's when they start, rather than flying off in separate directions, they actually become a unit or a team and are able to work together to survive whatever it is that's happening with the aliens outside. I really love that. I've enjoyed this conversation because I enjoyed watching the movie again. But I kind of felt, you know, one of y'all said it felt very old, and it certainly did. I'd be interested to see a story like this told in the age of cell phones, and especially smartphones, because, you know, their whole lifeline to the outside world is a old cathode ray tube TV, which I have, you know, does feel true to the time, but it is a completely different world now. But it's, the movie is just in the course of talking about it, really grown in my estimation. So thank y'all for that. So my last question, you know, to send us around the horn, as they would say on the main show, what is there to say about Signs that we haven't said yet? Is there anything in particular that you like about the movie, you don't like about the movie, any vein of meaning, or, you know, that we haven't mined yet? What do y'all got?
Well, I did have a question for you too, something I couldn't figure out when I was watching it this time. I was wondering what you make of this really predominant red, white, and blue color palette that's going on. Because it seems like almost every shot there's these washed out reds, whites, and blues. It's like almost as relentless as those three notes in the score. Like, is this something that's just like a nostalgic Americana sort of thing, shouting out to like the small town America of alien invasion movies from the 50s or something? Or is there something like some sort of message going on with these white and blue colors?
It's if you watch the and I'm glad you asked. I actually did watch some of the behind the scenes stuff, and they specifically mentioned that it is just a it meant to be a very subtle kind of Americana thing, right down to the that kind of Victorian Gothic farmhouse look, which you know it takes place in rural Pennsylvania, but that's something to me out of like Ray Bradbury, you know, a little bit more Midwestern or something. And I don't know enough about rural Pennsylvania to know if that architecture is true to the area or not, but and they even mentioned the paint scheme on the house, which I actually didn't notice. but yeah, it's supposed to just sort of evoke, you know, some kind of past small town America because that's where it's set. And I think they said something as well about sort of this kind of frontier motif where you've got, you know, an isolated family. You know, and the danger that that kind of poses, which is really interesting. But yeah, something not something I had noticed. I mean, it's really cool to me that you were able to pick up on that because I didn't catch it until I watched the special features.
Yeah, even though it wasn't what was intended, I do wonder how it could have been read right when it came out in the context of 9/11 that you were talking about earlier, like some kind of American nationalism fear of invasion thing going on. But I don't know. Sorry, Katie, I interrupted you.
No, I was going to say that the same thing. I hadn't noticed it particularly, but with you having pointed it out, you're right. It's kind of everywhere. The thing that I just wanted to mention that I hadn't said before is that I really appreciate in this movie the way that he, the way that they, because I mean I know it would have been his sound people, but the way that they're using non-musical sounds to create those feelings of disquiet and to set the scene. Because you've got those few times, like when they see the aliens standing on the roof of the lake, anytime there's a big jump scare, there'll be that like doo-doo, like that like Hitchcock music note that happens. But to me, what set the mood for me, particularly because, you know, I saw it in the movie theater and I don't remember noticing this, but I was with a bunch of friends around me, whatever. When I watched it yesterday, I watched it during the day because I'm still enough of a wimp that I didn't want to watch it after dark.
Me
and
either.
I didn't
Yeah,
want to feel
I
like there
watched
were
it at
aliens
like
staring
2 in
in my
the
windows.
afternoon.
Yes, okay, me too. So I watched it in the afternoon, my kids were whatever. I had headphones on. So wearing it with headphones, I was really hearing all of those non-musical sounds, and like the when he's running through the corn, I couldn't get over how much that wind in the corn sound. It sounds just exactly like water, like rushing water, like the footsteps on the roof and on the porch, like all the random little like bird flappings and the kids laughing in the other room and all that kind of stuff. I felt like all those things really did a lot more to give me that feeling of dread or isolation or whatever than any musical cue that they put in any more overtly scary scene. And I really appreciated that this time. The you know, I don't know, thanks Foley artists on Signs. Like, I mean, it was just really, really, really good. All that kind of stuff at setting the scene. What was that? There was one other thing I was gonna say, and I had it in my notes, but if I can't find it, what I know we've talked for a long time, so I may or may not mention it because I can't. Yeah, I don't. Oh, no, I was just gonna say, I just wanted to say one more time that how impressive the child actors are in the movie, which I talked a lot about Morgan as a character, like the way that he was written was impressive, but the way that he performed it, I'd forgotten that it was Rory Culkin, which by the way, and I'm not, this is not a criticism, all the Culkins sound alike and they all
They
sound
do.
amazing. Like they have some of the most distinctive voices I've ever heard on children. But even, I mean, Tiny Abigail Breslin does a really good job. You know, they seem like real kids and that they don't, they're neither, they're not too precociously cute, And, you know, but they also act like regular kids. I bought these children. They made sense. They seemed to fit. And they, most especially because they vacillated between seeming very, very, very young, but also kind of rising to the occasion in this really difficult situation. The only other thing I was going to say is that way back, you guys, one of you guys mentioned Independence Day. And I was going to say, to me, this film does feel like Independence Day, but it feels like Independence Day, like if you just focused on one family in one place. Because you have the same worldwide incursion, multiple cities threatened, strange things in the sky. One area of people figures out how to defeat them. So then they all start to leave. All the, like, a lot of those same beats that happen in Independence Day, but instead of showing us the most important people mounting the most important resistance, we get one family in one town and what is happening with them. And I thought that was kind of interesting. It's like showing us a microscope version of, you know, an event like Independence Day, but, you know, and ignoring everything else except for what they see on the TV. Like you said, the TV in the closet, which always makes me think of my other favorite scene, which is when, you know, he finds them in the closet with the foil hats on. And then later on, he comes home and, you know, Joaquin Phoenix sitting between the two little kids, also wearing his foil hat.
Yes.
That's my favorite part of the whole movie.
Yeah.
Because again, so childlike, like the look on his face, everything. He just looks up like he's bought into it completely. And it's just beautiful. I love it.
That's great. Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the sound mix, because I watched this like you said in the middle of the afternoon, because I am still, as much as I enjoy that atmosphere, you know, the nighttime something in the cornfield atmosphere, it does get to me. And I was watching it on our TV in the living room, and we do not have any kind of special sound system or anything, but there were like twigs snapping behind me. And you know, I could hear noises coming from what seemed to me to be the kitchen during those scenes, especially at night in the cornfields, and it, you know, it creeped me out. So yeah, that's a really great thing to mention. And Rory Culkin as well. The scene where he has to kill the dog, which, not that I endorse dog killing, but you know, it's gutsy for a movie to kill a dog. That almost never happens. But the scene where he kills the dog, the regret that he very palpably feels, you know, felt very like very real for a child, because he did it, but he didn't want to have to do it. And he's sitting there with the dog, you know, it's a dog that he loved, but he loved his sister more. That was really, really well done, especially for the two of them. The last couple of things I'd maybe mention about the movie are. First of all, the CGI alien at the end looks really terrible.
Yep.
It's
so bad.
It looks really bad. Especially since they did the Jaws thing and didn't really show it until the very end, and then it looks that awful. And by contrast, I mean, this is the same couple of years when the Lord of the Rings movies are coming out. Like the fall after this movie, we saw Gollum for the first time in the Two Towers. So, I mean, it's pretty bad. It has not aged well, and it was distracting. And hiding it in the reflection of a TV screen and with all that light coming in the windows behind it didn't really help either. I think it's a testament to the strength of the movie that it survives that terrible CGI. And the last thing I'd mention, I've alluded to this before, but I feel like, you know, Mel Gibson's performance is the real heart of the movie, and he's doing so much really incredibly subtle stuff, and especially playing a much gentler character than he typically plays or apparently is in real life. It is really, really incredible, and he plays so well, especially, again, off of Joaquin Phoenix and the kids and Cherry Jones. I mean, just it's... I was really blown away by it. At the time that I saw the movie originally, he was just Mel Gibson. I knew who he was, but now, you know, there's so much going on with his character, with his performance. I can't see this movie having been done by anybody else. And knowing some of what he's, you know, his religious fervor and his kind of tortured personal life has maybe added a layer of pathos to the performance in the intervening 20 years or 18 years, I guess. Well, this was really great. Katie and Marie, thanks for joining me. I really enjoyed talking through the movie, and thanks for raising it in my estimation. I appreciate that.
Yeah, I had a great time. Thank you for leading the discussion. It's been an awesome time. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks. Yeah. Well, again, this is Jordan Poss with City of Man. City of Man is a show on the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Please check out the network's website at christianhumanist.org or visit the various social media presences that the network has on Facebook and Twitter. On behalf of Coyle Neal and the City of Man podcast, this is Jordan Poss reminding you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's and unto God those things that are God's, and have a happy Halloween.
I'm insane with anger!